Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast. Listen, if you want hacks, my friend, I'm afraid you're in the wrong place. Our philosophy has grown out of the 10K Collective London Masterminds. Members, by the way, make between $500,000 and $7 million a year in e-commerce, mostly on Amazon. Many have doubled revenue in the last 12 to 18 months. If you're that kind of person, this podcast is made for you. We're not puritanical. We use hacks. We just don't think you should focus on them if you're building a real business. Instead, we focus on what's been proven to work in the group. Real brand building, clear strategic objectives, courageous long-term goals, and long-range thinking. If you like that focus, keep listening, and welcome to the 10K Collective. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to the 10K Collective podcast put out there by the amazing FBA, sort of family of podcasts. It's one and the same thing, more or less, except the 10K Collective podcast is geared to the needs of six, seven and eight figure Amazon sellers. And as we get into 2020, more broadly, e-commerce sellers as well. Now, today's guest is an expert, not so much in the e-commerce sphere or the Amazon bubble, but in valuation of companies. And that guest is Terry Lammers of Innovative Business Advisors. Just to quickly recap, he helps people buy and sell businesses, value businesses, and this is a bit we're going to focus on today, he's got a CEO to CEO coaching system, which sounds stupid until you realize, okay, why would a CEO want to become the CEO? But it means chief everything officer to chief executive officer. I really like that because that resonates with me, as we call it in Britain, chief cook and bottle washer. That's me. That's my title, as it says over the door. So tell me a little bit more about the overview of this. Why have you created this in the first place?
Yeah. So we've always had a coaching aspect to our business, coaching and some consulting. And this is something that we just labeled it. I mean, we're fresh out of the gate with it at the beginning of this year. It's not even on our website yet, but it will be shortly. So for us as a business, it creates a little bit more of a recurring revenue versus selling businesses, which is very transactional. But for the business owner, the reason we came up with it is we really identify that there is a huge need for business owners to understand their financial statements. So we concentrate on three things in the CEO program: understanding your financial statements and making sure your financial statements are readable and relevant. We run into things where anywhere where the person has a one page financial statement, which isn't necessarily bad, or to where they got eight pages, you know, but is everything correct on your financial statements? And then we're going to help you put them into a trend. And then we're going to teach you 8 to 10 financial ratios that'll really help you keep a finger on the health of your company. The second thing that we'll teach you in the CEO program is your bankability. Are you a bankable person? Because likely, if you have to grow your business, there's going to be a need for you to go to the bank and borrow money. So we'll help you create a debt schedule and get you to understand how bankable you are to a bank. And then the third thing that we do is talk to you about non-financial things that can affect the value or sellability of your company. And it's often these non-financial things that say, you know, doesn't lower the value of your company from $1 million to $800,000. It may make your company completely unsellable. And as we talked about in the last podcast, you know, if you're that business owner that is counting on the sale of your business to fund your retirement, it's very important that you have a sellable company, right?
Absolutely. In the end, the valuation of something that's unsellable is just a nice theory, isn't it? Or not even a nice one. It's a waste of time theory. I mean, it's like people who put the houses on the market in the UK. And recently in London, we bought a house and somebody had a flat on the market for a while ago, £700,000. So that's got to be getting on for $1 million these days. And that was a lovely valuation, but it sat there for about 9 months and didn't sell. So the actual value of the house was a lot less because that's what we bought it for. So, I mean, in the end, that's as you say, any valuation that means something's not sellable it's kind of like something that's broken the circle completely. All right. Well, look, tell me about the financials. I love the teach 8 to 10 financial ratios. Everyone loves lists of 8 or 10 or 7, the magic lists so that the internet runs on. So tell me, before we get into that, what are the main things? When people say financial statements, what are those things? What are the names of those?
Primarily your income statement and your balance sheet. So from those from your income statement and your balance sheet, we can come up with those ratios. And you know, probably the main ones to hit on is, you know, what's your current ratio, which is, you know, what's your current assets versus your current liabilities. And that's going to show the liquidity of your company. And that's something the banker is going to want to look at. You know, what's your ability to, you know, absorb extra expenses or something like that, that shows up in your current ratio. You want to see that be about a 2, which means 2 times current assets versus current liabilities. We'll determine your daily sales. And then from your daily sales, we're going to figure out what's your accounts receivable days, accounts payable days, and inventory days. So how fast are you collecting your money from the time that you sell the product that you're selling? Accounts payable days, how quickly are you paying your account, you know, your bills? And inventory days, if you have inventory in the company, how many days does it take you to flip that inventory? So those are some very important things that help, you know, how the cash is flowing in and out of your company and what working capital needs you might need. Another 2 ratios that are good to pay attention to. If you remember from before, I said it's not about sales and net income. It's about gross profit and cash flow. So what is your gross profit margin? And that's why we want to put your financial statements into an income trend to see what that gross profit margin is doing. If your sales are going up, but your gross profit margin is going down, that means somewhere in your cost of goods sold, you're absorbing more expenses. And then we really want to look at your cash flow margin. You know, what's that cash flow margin doing? Is it staying consistent? You know, is it going up or down? And if, you know, if that is fluctuating down, you know, it means you're increasing your operating expenses. So those are just some simple ones that we really help people get their hands around. And we want to help you get, you know, your income statement. What I don't like about traditional accounting forms is, you know, you look at, this was my sales and net income for January of this year and January of last year, and to compare the two. Or this was my January through July year to date income for 2020 versus my January through July year to date income for 2019. What I like to see is in a monthly trend, and then do that same thing with your balance sheet. And then we create that ratio analysis page. So you're looking at those key ratios on a monthly basis.
Okay, so I guess what I'm getting from that, there's quite a few details that to dig into, but a lot of this stuff, it seems to be current ratio, I guess, is about a balance sheet ratio, isn't it? So the assets versus liabilities, accounts receivable days, accounts payable days, inventory days. I guess those are also cash flow related, right? I mean, okay, it's going to, everything in the end affects profit and loss, everything affects everything. But it strikes me that even that the gross profit margin is definitely a profit and loss one by definition, but it's not the bottom line or the top line. So it's quite interesting where you put your focus, which is quite interesting. I guess the thing that everyone in Amazon businesses is forever saying is the top line revenue, which is an interesting one. Tell me a bit about then, you mentioned in the last episode, and the reason we're looking at this one, by the way, the last episode, if you haven't listened to it yet, very interesting one about business valuation. And the reason why we're really focusing on the CEO to CEO sort of movement from not understanding to understanding your business from a financial perspective, primarily, it seems, is in order to be able to then pull the right levers to increase the value of the asset that you can then sell. So why are accounts receivable and payable days and inventory days? Why are those things important for improving the value of a company?
You know, that's really, it's more of a cash flow. We talk about how the cash is flowing through the company. It doesn't really have an impact on the bottom line. It's just how the cash is being absorbed in the company. If your accounts, so let's say you're selling $10,000 worth of stuff a day. If your accounts receivable goes from 20 days to 30 days, you know, your AR increased by 10 days at $10,000 worth of sales a day. That's $100,000. You know, that's $100,000 of stuff that you sold that's not in your checkbook yet. So if you got a, you know, if you could create a cash shortage for you paying your bills, which may mean that you need a line of credit or something like that to fund that. I think I gave an example last time in my previous company, you know, my accounts receivable days were 27 and my accounts payable days were 12. So I had 15 days to fund, you know, before I received the cash from something I sold. So if I have $100,000 a day in sales, that 15 days is 1.5 million. You know, if my sales, my top line revenue increases to $200,000 a day And that same 15 days, now I need $3 million to fund that. Or if I'm not paying attention to collecting my bills and I have clients that are getting past due and, you know, my receivable days go from 27 to 37, you know, if you had $100,000 a day in sales, you just sucked up a lot of cash, which can really create a problem with the checkbook.
Absolutely. Yeah. And by the way, I think this is, you're describing the life of a lot of serious Amazon sellers. If you're doing $100,000 a day or, you know, $3 million a month, that's pretty serious, but it's very achievable with Amazon. I mean, okay, even if you're doing $10,000 a day and you're ending up with, what's that, $3 million a month, then that's not that uncommon for a mature Amazon business. But suddenly you're looking at a lot more money to cover that. Now, let's talk about the definition of working capital, because that seems to be a word that turns up a lot. Is that what you mean by working capital, or what is this word?
Yeah, primarily, working capital is the cash that you need to fund your company, the day-to-day activities of your company. You know, if even in a simple situation, if your accounts receivable days are 30, you know, it's taking you 30 days to collect that money, and let's say that's $500,000. Well, in that 30 days, if you have employees, you're like, you know, you're gonna have bills to incur in that time period. So how much money do you need to cover that gap? And that's really your working capital.
This definition of putting it. And that, I think, by the way, that's one of the things people are forever, it's one of the things that I ask people who want to start off in with me as a mentoring client, starting from scratch. I'd say, okay, how much money can you put in initially, and how much money do you want to make at the other end in terms of revenue, which is probably a dumb question. I should probably ask them what profit they want to make. But anyway, there's often a really poor understanding of how much money you may need to have in the company to cover things like Q4, when in July, August, typically maybe September, you've got a bit of a cash flow down spike when you've ordered a load of product and you're shipping it across from China and it's on the water and it's not selling. And then you start selling through. And then by the end of Q4, like in December, January time, you've got the money back in. I think what people don't get is the amount of money you have in the bank, whether it's yours or the bank's or whoever else you've borrowed it from, or equity invested it from, if you like, that has to be enough to cover the lowest point of cash. I mean, what do you have to say to that point? Because I think that is one of those things that...
Sure. It's very real. And yeah, a lot of people, that's where they really get in a pinch. So, you know, I tell people all the time, you know, understanding how the cash flow goes through your company is vitally important, because you can have a profitable company and go broke, not because you wasn't profitable, but because you just flat ran out of cash. You know, so in my situation, I mean, if I didn't pay a fuel bill on time, you had to pay for fuel in 10 days. And I mean, they just EFT'd it right out of your account. And so I have 10 days credit. Well, if I miss a fuel bill, and they put me on cash, and now I have no credit, you know, and back to selling $100,000 worth of stuff a day, I go, you know, that's $1 million that I might have to come up, and that'll break the company. Same way with, you know, any business owner, you know, if you can't pay the bill and your supplier cuts you off, or you can't make payroll and your employees quit, it could put you out of business. So it is vitally important to understand the working capital needs and, you know, what you need to fund that company.
Amen to that. I mean, I think that's the, I think somebody said once, I can't remember who it was, it said, look, there's only one way a business fails, and that's running out of money, which is kind of true. I mean, you look at those crazy venture-backed startups that burn through cash every month for several years, and you got to think, well, I don't think I'd really want to own that, but you know, eventually profit does matter. But the thing about profit is, if you're not profitable yet, you can live to fight another day if you've got cash, whereas if you're hugely profitable and you run out of cash, it's game over, which is particularly tragic, I think. And I do occasionally see that. I mean, most of the time, the businesses that I work with that are serious that have got enough capitalization, but you know, you have to watch it like a hawk, right? And it's very interesting that we're ending up talking about basically financials and cash flow planning, like an accountancy type discussion, when, you know, I thought we were going to be talking about, you know, that as part of the picture for valuation. I mean, is the financial ratio analysis and cash planning and stuff, is that normally the thing that people are weakest on when you find that they want to improve the value of their company? Or are there other aspects as well?
I think there's just a general, it amazes me, and not really. I mean, because, you know, I don't know anything about Amazon, but I know about cash flow, right? So, if you have a listener, you know, owns a very small business and they're like, man, I just don't understand this financial thing. Well, you know, don't feel bad about it, but you'd also be surprised. There's people out there running pretty large companies and they don't get it either. But it is so important because, you know, and I didn't know this stuff all the time. I mean, when I was, you know, back in first started with the oil company, I was growing my company by 100% and 20% at least every year. And man, I was always struggling with the cash. And I didn't know why. It's like, man, I'm making money. Look at my net income, you know, look at my the amount of money that's coming in. I'm making money. But what I didn't get at the time is my growth was stretching my working capital requirements. I wasn't making the money as fast as my working capital was growing. And that's why a lot of banks will ding a company, check mark in the bad column for a company growing too fast because it may be stretching your working capital requirements. And, you know, the beautiful thing about a lot of your listeners are selling stuff on Amazon, what you're probably collecting your money the next day or within 3 days. That's a beautiful thing.
Well, you say that, but the typical cash flow for a private label seller when you start off is that you pay for the money. You pay 30% deposit traditionally when you're first starting out before you can get really great supplier credit terms. Before they manufacture, 30 days later, typically you pay 70% down and then it's on the water for 60 days. Traditionally, again, it depends if you air freight it. Maybe it's only 10 days freight.
Yeah.
Then Amazon prepares it, but then you only get to sell that inventory through over the course of 3 months, really. So you have actually got a pretty bad working capital situation for a lot of people. That's something that people need to get very real about with that particular business model. I mean, people sell businesses every day of the week that they built up on Amazon, and it can be a great business model for sure. But I know that from a fact from multiple people that I know very, very well who've made a nice payday for themselves. But you have to be deadly serious about the working capital requirements. Yeah. So go on.
Yeah. So I was going to say, let's transfer that then to what is your bankability?
Exactly. So I was going to ask, you're referencing the banks. Yeah. And yeah, going too fast means the bank doesn't like you. Tell me more about that.
Yeah. So, you know, it's funny. I have a coaching client right now that when they first came to me, he has kind of a blue collar company, you know, they actually work on diesel trucks and, you know, he's kind of a gruff, you know, and he had that attitude of like, well, I'll tell that banker, he's just, you know, he doesn't know what he's talking about and blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, you don't understand your financial statements. You're not a very bankable person. So, you know, the first thing that we do with doing that is one, we got to get to the true cash flow of the customer. So that jumps back to the financial second statements. But then two, we'll help you create a debt schedule. What's a debt schedule? So it's a list of all of your loans. And what, you know, what was the original loan amount? What's the collateral for that loan? What's the monthly payment? You know, when is the loan due? And this is very important information and probably the hardest thing for your banker to get together from clients. It's like, okay, where's all these loans at? You know, what's your monthly payments? And that's going to help us get to your debt service coverage ratio. But then that'll also help us, you know, say you buy a piece of property and, you know, a piece of real estate, and there was a 20-year note on it. You know, you took a 20-year loan. Well, say that loan payment is $2,000 a month. Well, if you're 15 years into that loan payment and you want to expand your company, maybe we can refinance that note and borrow some more money against that property, and maybe it lowers your debt payment. I recently working with a client, they wanted to open another location and they needed $100,000 to get that location open, you know, improvements and stuff like that. Well, we went out and borrowed $100,000, but refinanced his debt and lowered his monthly payments by like $6,000 a month. So, you know, but then more importantly, it's important to get your debt schedule, but it's important to understand what a bank is thinking. And it's important to get you to the right bank. People think a bank is a bank. Well, it's not. I mean, some banks don't want a loan on construction, or some banks don't want a loan on non-owner occupied real estate. Another bank may not want a loan on a restaurant. So you need to make sure you're getting yourself to the right bank. But more importantly, it's good to know what your debt service coverage ratio. In other words, you want to make sure you got what? And so what we said in the last episode, a minimum is typically 1.25, but I think that's very low. So that's $1.25 in income to every dollar's worth of debt. I would rather you see you around 1.7 at a minimum. So $1.70 income to every dollar's worth of debt. But then the other thing we do to help you with your bankability is, you know, you have a balance sheet and that represents your assets at book cost. I'd like to help a client make a balance sheet with their assets at market value because that's the collateral value for your bank. So it's getting the client to understand how bankable am I? And that will often play a large part in how you may be able to fund the growth of the company or possibly an acquisition or to be able to handle, you know, a line of credit for the working capital. Those are all things to be thinking about in that bankability sphere.
You're quite right. And amongst Amazon sellers, because it is such a capital intensive business and the cash flow side of it is quite difficult because there is traditionally quite a gap. I mean, between when you pay your money out to your supplier and when you get paid by Amazon from the consumers, it is always a constant discussion, really. And people will juggle their credit card debt and goodness knows what. We were discussing the other day about this. So this bankability piece, I think, is really key. And even if you don't want to have really major debt, I mean, even if you look at your figures and it tells you that you can get away with not getting bank loans if you grow at, say, 25% a year. But if you want to grow 100% a year, then you really, really, really need to know about this stuff. Tell me a little bit more then. You were saying choosing the right bank. That's very important, obviously. And by the way, also true for Amazon sellers, my tip to you is Handelsbank, as it's called in the UK. It's actually German bank. Handeln means to trade. So they are geared to trading companies, as the name would imply. And they're one of the banks that seems to be most sort of favorable. So just a little hint there. I do not work for Handelsbank and I'm not an affiliate, so I may not be absolutely on with that. Just a little hint. But coming back to what the bank is thinking, what they're understanding. So this also I think is a very important piece of the puzzle. If I'm sitting there as the business owner, as you said, your blue collar friend, like he doesn't know anything about this. Our business is different from every other business. This is the common thinking that entrepreneurs have, right? My industry works differently for everything else. What is the person on the opposite side of the desk, the bank manager or the bank loan officer, whatever they're called? What's in their mind? What do they want to see? What are they nervous about? What do they want to see?
They're going to be, you know, really it boils down to two things. Like I said before, the collateral and the cash flow. And you need to have, a lot of people don't want to sit down and talk to their bankers or ask them this stuff, but it's important for you to ask them, what are you looking at? What do you want to see? You know, like we mentioned about a current ratio, you know, if your current ratio is one to one, so you have $1 worth of assets for every, you know, $1 worth of current assets for every dollar, $1 worth of current liabilities, that may make your banker nervous. You know, ask him, where do you want to see that number? And in the same way with collateral, what are they, you know, it used to frustrate the heck out of me. I would tell them I got $1 million worth of trucks and they're like, yeah, but we're only going to use about $700,000 worth of it as collateral. Well, so they're discounting that by 30%. So ask the bank what they're looking for with collateral. And the whole thing I would tell you is you need to have that conversation with the banker. Don't let it be a surprise. Ask them what they're looking at for you. Ask them, you know, I used to meet with my banker at the beginning of every year and tell them, you know, look, I'm planning on buying this truck or I'm planning on buying this company. I'm going to need $500,000 to borrow another $500,000 and make sure they have a heads up for what you're thinking. You know, they don't like surprises.
I mean, I have to say, it's quite funny that sometimes you speak to experts and they say something that as soon as they say it, you think, duh, that was embarrassingly obvious answer, which is number one, ask them. And number two, tell them. So in other words, ask them what they've been nervous about and then communicate. And by the way, on a similar vein, I had one of the Mastermind members, he's also been on the podcast, Ashley Pierce, was talking about the fact that, strangely enough, if you communicate with your suppliers about what you're planning to do this year and give them a heads up that you're going to need 100,000 units of a particular product line later down the year, they can also do their cash flow projections if you're a significant one of their clients as well.
One of the things I talk about in the book and that I would also throw out there to your listeners is, especially if you get a little bit of a larger company, I would highly encourage you just to, maybe you don't split your banking relationship between two banks, but to always talk to another bank. I mean, it'll happen that banks will change their lending policies. And now all of a sudden, you know, maybe they don't want to lend to your industry anymore. You know, so it's always a great idea to at least, you know, have a relationship or be talking to a banker from another bank. In my personal situation back in the day, I had my real estate loans at one bank. I had my line of credit and checkbook at another bank. And I actually gave a third bank my financial statements and tax returns and kept them interested in doing business with me so that if one of the other banks hiccuped, I had a place to go.
And by the way, this is this brings us quite neatly to things that I've heard from another business valuation expert recently on the podcast, which is always having a plan B. And in that case, he was talking about having a second supplier. He was talking about one particular business sale that nearly fell through completely because the supplier turned around when they got in touch with them a few days before closing and said, oh, by the way, the supplier said, oh yeah, we've decided not to service businesses like yours anymore. You got 48 hours to take our products off your website and off Amazon, which was, unfortunately, they had gone through a due diligence process. They had a plan B, and a month later, they had the new supplier in place and sold the business. So that's an absolutely classic case.
So and that kind of rounds into a non-financial thing that could really affect the value of a company. You know, we call it, in our system, we call it the Switzerland structure. So Switzerland was a very independent country, right? And didn't fight in any of the world wars or anything like that. So is your company independent of anyone's supplier, anyone customer, or anyone employee? And you know, you're hitting the nail on the head there. You know, if you got all your eggs in one basket, so to speak, it's a little bit more of a dangerous situation. I talk about a company that was a big customer of mine all the time. So one, you know, the independence to a customer, this guy ran about 50 trucks and he delivered the milk from a milk processing plant. So, you know, 50 trucks, 10,000 gallons of fuel a day or week, you know, that's a lot of stuff. But guess how many customers he had? One customer. So think about that. Is that company really sellable if it only has one customer?
By the way, in Britain, there's a company which I find fascinating, which is Ocado, O-C-A-D-O. And they supply one very good, but one single company, which is Waitrose. Waitrose, by the way, weirdly enough, is not a listed company. It's one of those rare cooperatives. So Waitrose and John Lewis are actually owned by the people who work there, which is very sweet. And I think that's actually an excellent idea in many ways, but slightly different business model. And then Ocado is a publicly listed company in the UK Stock Exchange or the FTSE, but actually only has one supplier, which one person they supply to, which is Waitrose. And I always look at them and I think, I'm absolutely amazed that anyone would allow you to be a quasi-separate company, because you're not separate. Because if Waitrose turned around and said, we are going to finish this relationship, they would be absolutely valueless. So the one company, although I'm happy to have them deliver my groceries because Waitrose does lovely things and it's quite pricey but good quality, I would never ever buy that company for that exact reason. So I think you put your finger on a very important basic thing, which is like never just have one of anything in your business, one customer, one supplier, or, and thank you for flagging that up, one bank, which so makes sense as soon as you say it, but we get lazy, right? So we're going to need to wrap things up fairly soon here, but I would love to have your, we've gone over a lot of really great stuff. And just to reiterate, we talked about the financials, the bankability and the non-financials. Just any other thoughts on the non-financial things that are the most critical ones?
Probably the most critical one in my mind that I run into most often, especially with smaller companies, we call the hub and spoke. So are you the hub of your company, you know, and the spokes are the customers, the suppliers, and the employees? They're all coming to you. So if I take you out of that company, it'll no longer function. So it's very much something to think about as you're growing your company. You need to continually pull yourself out of the company so that company can run on its own. And buyers, you know, that's the number one, gosh, I tell you, we could spend a whole nother episode talking about it. You know, if you are intimately involved in that company, whoever buys you has to be intimately involved in that company. So it's a hard thing to go from. You know, I remember the days when I had to drive a truck every day too. But, you know, at the end, when I sold the company, I had three operations managers and an office manager. I could tell, you know, can you go on vacation for 2 weeks and will that company survive?
It's a really excellent test. Can you go on vacation? Let me just write this down. Can you go on vacation for 2 weeks and your company survives? I guess if your company even thrives without you, then that's even better, right? And by the way, that sounds like I guess it's not even, how can I put this? It's not just an employee mentality. It's kind of in worth entrepreneurs. It's that kind of, I always liken it to parents, really. Like a good parent will be very, very involved in their children's lives, but they recognize they're an independent entity. And sooner or later, we have to let go of the reins if we're going to sell a company and say, okay, you know what? The fact that the company actually does better when I'm not around may hit my ego, but it makes my company really sellable. So we've got to transact ego for cash, right?
I think I think my employees enjoyed it when I wasn't around.
Yeah, so, you know what? I'm having a very mini experience of that. Sometimes the podcast runs more smoothly when my assistant is running it, really. And I say assistant, I guess she's kind of turning into a podcast manager. I'm very happy about that, actually. I have to say that part of my ego thinks that I want things to be better when I'm around, but mostly I recognize that hopefully the value I bring to people is interviewing experts and bringing out, you know, what they have to offer. I'm just a channel. So,
there's more of the non-financial things that affect the value of the company, but another important one I want to get out there before we go is recurring revenue. Companies with recurring revenue will always sell more for companies that are transactional. So, you know, if you're a construction company that builds homes, once you build a home, you got to go find another home to build, right? Versus, you know, if you're selling coffee, people are going to drink coffee every morning. So that's more of a recurring thing. They have to have that. You know, me selling fuel, you know, farmers are going to farm every year. They're going to need that fuel. A disadvantage of owning a brokerage company is, again, it's very transactional. Once I sell that company, now I got to go find another company to sell. So, and there's all kinds of, you know, subscription models that you can build into companies that, you know, people are automatically renewing with the HVAC companies. You know, one of the first questions that'll be asked is, do you have service contracts? You know, because likely those will renew every year. So think about that. You know, whether you're wanting to start a business or buy a business, or even you have your current business, what can I do to build recurring revenue in that company?
Thank you. That's a really excellent point, actually. And one of the issues around Amazon-based businesses is that, broadly speaking, it's very sort of front-end centric. So we obsess about getting a sale of a customer and then another sale from a different customer. And actually, if you can build any element of recurring revenue, you can do it on the Amazon platform itself. You could start building it through your Shopify store or whatever it is. But any element you can build into that, this is just another reinforcement of the fact that it's not just extra cash now, but it is adding, I guess, sellability, not just even a multiple to the value of your company, but it makes it more likely to sell, right? So yeah, there's sort of three or four good reasons for doing it, not just one. So I think I totally agree with that. I mean, I'm lucky enough that not with the Amazon side of things so much, but with Amazing FBA, I do very much try and engineer recurring revenue situations. At the moment, I sell a course, which is a one-off payment, and I'm wanting to transition that to a subscription business. But the mentoring and the masterminds are a subscription-based income. And I can say for sure that it's a lot more reassuring. You sleep a lot better at night when you've got recurring revenue as well, right? Yes. As a business owner, I can only imagine that if I was selling it to somebody, I mean, the trouble with the podcast is very much a hub and spoke model. It's all about me, unfortunately. I kind of wish it weren't, but Amazon businesses are incredibly sellable. So this is a very, very relevant episode for anyone who is even thinking of creating an FBA business, let alone anyone who owns a decent one. This is incredibly important stuff. I'd really urge you to check out the same things that I mentioned last episode, which is, first of all, the book, You Don't Know What You Don't Know, which is great. Everything you need to know about how to buy or sell your business by Terry Lammers, Lammers. Let me just, Terry, just show us that again. Terry's just holding it up now. You Don't Know What You Don't Know, bright yellow on a lovely blue background. Terry Lammers, Lammers CVA, which is Chartered Value.
Certified Valuation Analyst.
Certified Valuation Analyst. Thank you. And the also, there's a space where you can get a quick valuation of your company if you go to amazingfba.com/value, V-A-L-U-E, then that will redirect to the valuation services link that they have at Terry's website, which is Innovative BA. That's B for Business, A for advisors.com. So that's where you can go. And I'd urge anyone who can to get any conversations with somebody who's willing to talk to you, who's got that level of expertise. I mean, I didn't even mention in the intro, but Terry's bought and sold quite a few businesses, I believe, of his own. You've been an entrepreneur in several businesses, right?
Yeah. So I grew up in a family wholesale and fuel lubricants company. And in the 20 years that I owned that, you know, it's a family company. So I took it over. I had the opportunity to purchase 11 other companies, and I grew it from $750,000 a year to over $42 million. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty whopping increase. So I should have probably mentioned that right at the beginning of the podcast. But just for those who are thinking, oh, should I bother to get in touch with Terry? Listen, if you can get a word with somebody who's acquired 11 companies and grown a company from $700,000 a year to $42 million a year, I would jump at the chance. I mean, I'm very lucky in the privileged position of podcasting to get to talk to people of that sort of caliber. I mean, so if you can get some input from Terry, that would be really good. Terry, do you offer any sort of coaching things or some initial coaching calls? How does that work? Just for
anybody? Yeah, first call is always free, you know, initial call. The CEO program, we offer it one-to-one, or we have small groups of five. We do them by Zoom. In the St. Louis area, we do them in person, but coach clients all over the place, you know, using Zoom. So it works out really well.
Yeah. And having used Zoom for coaching for several years myself, I can attest to the simplicity and the value of that kind of thing. I've been a coachee myself and I've coached others. So very effective in the end. One-to-one coaching is probably the gold standard for developing any skill set ever, whether that be piano lessons with Mozart back in the 18th century or you know, 21st century digital skills. One-to-one is always the way to go. So if you're serious about this stuff, guys, do urge you to get in touch with Terry. Just remains for me to say, Terry, thank you very, very much for coming on and sharing some valuable insights.
Too, please. If anybody needs a speaker, let me know. I'd be happy to do a speaking engagement.
Thank you. We'll bear that in mind. Anyone who happens to listen to the podcast, who runs any kind of speaking things, then bear Terry in mind as a great speaker as well. And you've had a chance to sample his wares here. So Terry, many, many thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks. Appreciate all you listeners.
Thanks for listening to the 10K Collective podcast. I really hope you found the show helpful. I mentioned the London-based masterminds we've been running since September 2017. Members of the 10K Collective Mastermind make a minimum of about £480,000 a year, well over €600,000 or dollars. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/10KC, K for Kilo, C for Charlie. £1 million mastermind members make a minimum of £1.2 million a year. That's about $1.5 million US dollars or euros. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/MPM. That's M for Mother, P for Peter, M for Mother. Thanks for listening.